Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Thanks for tuning in. Welcome to the debut of the Adult BBS station. The Shame Free Zone will probably still continue to air on Monday nights for a couple more weeks, but eventually we're going to transition over here to Thursday at 8 p.m. Pacific time. And just because I'm going adult does not mean that we are going to lose the spiritual aspects of our discussions. Not in the least. It just means that we're going to be able to have a little more frank conversation. And if you do decide you want to call in with your questions or comments, you could speak freely because it's going to be just between us adults. You might also think about emailing me. And you're welcome to email me throughout the week. If you want to send me some questions or comments that you'd like me to read on the air, just pop those into your inbox or into my inbox at veronica@sexwithoutshame.com. That's veronica@sexwithoutshame.com. If you ever have trouble finding me, it's real easy. Go to any search engine, type in the words Monet, M-O-N-E-T, just like Claude Monet, the impressionistic painter, and the word sex. And you'll get pages and pages about me. Not all of it is true. Most of it is, but not all of it, so. You know, you can't read. Believe everything you read. I am kicking off a brand new series tonight. And this has been dubbed Prostitution 101. Maybe you live in the Bay Area. If you do, you might have recently seen an episode on KCRA. KCRA in Sacramento. That's Channel 3 in Sacramento, California. And they aired an episode called Prostitution 101, accused me of teaching Prostitution 101 to the college students. And as a matter of fact, they came in to the classroom and videotaped me working with the students, interviewed the professor that I was guest lecturing for, Dr. David Hall, and the university was University of the Pacific. And, you know, kind of to their chagrin, found out that I wasn't actually teaching college co-eds how to be prostitutes. I was giving them lessons in the history of prostitution and the sex worker rights movement. And then, of course, my own personal stories. I spent quite a few years in the sex industry, started working in the sex industry in the fall of 1989, and I retired from the sex industry in January of 2004. So that's a pretty long and illustrious career. Did a lot of TV talk shows. I've been on everything from the Playboy Channel to CNN to Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect, Geraldo, et cetera, et cetera. More shows than I can count, to tell you the truth. But this year's been a very good year for me as well. Thanks to the politicians who cannot keep their peckers in their pants, people like Elliot Spitzer, who had to retire as governor of New York, and then John Edwards, who had put his hat in the ring as a potential candidate for president, and later got caught up in a scandal about cheating on his wife. So every time a politician creates a sex scandal, my telephone rings and the media calls me for commentary. I think it has something to do with all those cheating husbands that I used to see professionally. Anyway, you may have a lot of mixed feelings about prostitution. Perhaps somebody that you love, you know, maybe if you are in a relationship with a man, maybe your man has cheated on you with a prostitute. You may be very angry and upset about it. Maybe you have gone to see prostitutes at some time in your life, and you might have feelings of guilt or shame or embarrassment surrounding that, or maybe just fear, you know, fear of getting arrested if you weren't actually seeing a prostitute in the legal brothel in Nevada. because those are definitely risks. You may just feel that it's wrong. Maybe that, you know, it goes against, counter to your morals, your values, the religion that you were raised in. That's all a possibility. And I'm not necessarily to change your mind and make you feel differently about it, but I do hope to bring some information to you that might, you know, who knows? It might confirm how you feel. It might change how you feel. It might just add to your knowledge of a topic that a lot of people find quite interesting. I know people find it interesting because they've been interviewing me about it and asking me to come talk about it at their clubs and conferences and colleges for about 20 years now. So I thought we could start off tonight by actually talking about the history of prostitution. And you might think that you know all about it, or you might be intrigued. Maybe you've heard the word sacred prostitution. That's an oxymoron for a lot of people. It's kind of like, how could you possibly take something as banal and degrading and disgusting as prostitution and then go tack the word sacred on it? Some people think that that's just an attempt to clean our act up, you know, and say, oh, it's not so bad. It's not such an evil thing that we're doing here. It's sacred prostitution. But to tell you the truth, sacred prostitution predates what we consider prostitution today. It existed before streetwalking, before brothels, before any of the things that we associate with modern prostitution. Sacred prostitution was first. It was the very first thing. By the time you get to Greek and Roman times, you are already starting to leave sacred prostitution behind. So sacred prostitution really predates most history. And by the time people start writing things down in books, we have already started to make a very strong transition towards patriarchal values. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with the words patriarchy, but just for the benefit of those who may not be familiar with the term, it means male-dominated, and we see this coming out of cultures that have monotheism, usually a single male god figure who is very authoritarian, usually warlike, violent, jealous kind of god. And this becomes what the culture models itself after, so that it becomes very male-dominated, and sexually jealous, and very violent. And that's pretty much what we have with patriarchy. Now, there's a lot of theories about how this arose, because civilization actually starts taking root in more matrifocal societies. This is where we got our idea of numbers. The women were watching that their periods coincided with the phases of the moon. And when they saw that the moon predicted when they were going to bleed, they started keeping track of that, and this is where we got the months. This is how we started keeping track of time, which leads to the simple act of counting, which leads to the idea of numbers, and this is also where we ended up getting communication and record keeping and the alphabet. So many of the things that we absolutely love about civilization come out of ancient wisdom that came from women. And it's associated with the moon, it's associated with nighttime, it's associated with sex, it's associated with menstrual blood, it's associated with the earth. And darkness, you know, nighttime. These are things that are now, you know, vilified. We have these stories about witches, you know. Well, witches were originally just wise women who were actually revered, and people paid attention to what the wise women had to say because they were wise, for God's sake, you know. But anyway, the sacred prostitution is actually written about in one of the oldest and perhaps the oldest story ever told, which is the Epic of Gilgamesh. In the story of Gilgamesh, which it is believed to be the oldest, at least fictional, story ever written down, this story is all about a king and his best friend. And his best friend is an animal. Literally, this guy's out having sex with animals. He doesn't know how to bathe. You know, he drinks water by lapping it like he's a dog. He crawls around on all fours. You know, he's just refuses to act like a human being. And the king decides that what he's going to do is introduce his friend to a sacred prostitute. The reason that he's going to introduce Gilgamesh to a sacred prostitute is because the king knows the sacred prostitute will civilize the man. So at a very, very early stage in human history, we have this association with women, sacred prostitutes, sexuality, these three things, females, sacred prostitution, sexuality. You'll see over and over again these things have been demonized in our culture. Originally, they were revered, and it was known that this sacred prostitute, by having sex with this man, by spending time with this man, was going to civilize him. And in fact, she did. He became a human being after spending days and days making love with this woman, this sacred prostitute. So some feminists, and in particular second wave feminists, who really have a problem with that word prostitute will come along and say, well, they weren't really prostitutes. And you know, I guess I would counter and say, well, the idea of somebody wearing fishnets and trolling the streets for a drug habit is my idea of somebody who's not really a prostitute. I think the sacred prostitutes were. I love that that's the original meaning of that term. So, and in fact, in my career, soon after I started working, I started to embody a lot of the tenets of sacred prostitution in my profession, and it added a very profound and deep meaning to my work, which I'll talk about later in subsequent episodes of this program. But for tonight's purposes, we want to talk about basically whether or not prostitution is a natural part of being alive here on planet Earth. So obviously, if our oldest recorded story, oldest story written down, the Epic of Gilgamesh, extols the virtues of a sacred prostitute and how she brings civilization to society, this is antithetical to everything that we know and believe about prostitution today. Because now we believe that prostitution erodes family values and degrades society and ruins neighborhoods and brings crime into our cities. And I personally think that's just really sad that we've gotten to that point, moved so far away from its original intent. But in order to understand that, you have to understand this war that took place between these two factions. When women were more valued, and I hesitate to say in charge. I do believe that we had some matriarchal societies if you go far enough back, but matriarchy suggests is just a vagina instead of a penis that's in charge of the government, which to me doesn't really sound like it's that much of a difference. You know, women are not inherently more peaceful or loving or gentle or kind than men are. However, if you're thinking about the structure being completely different so that it's matrifocal, this would be a little more like what you would expect to find with Iroquois Indian, for instance, which I'm part Iroquois Indian. And the Iroquois Indian inhabited the eastern seaboard, the northeastern states of the United States. And they were originally five nations, then they became six nations. What made them unique was that they were a confederacy, a group of tribes who had come together to cooperate and live together peacefully. And they had a system of checks and balances. Does this sound familiar? We supposedly live in a country that has checks and balances in its government. You know, we have Congress, we have the Senate, we have the judicial system, and we've got our president, and they all work in concert with each other, but they also work at cross purposes in order to ensure that no segment of our government ever becomes too powerful. Well, the Iroquois are actually the ones who invented that whole concept. Some people will tell you that that comes from the Greeks, but for my money and the studying that I've done, I think the Iroquois had a huge impact on our infantile nation. And when those 13 states were coming together to become the United States of America, I think the Iroquois way of doing things had a huge impact on them. And why wouldn't it? You know, the 13 colonies were right there in Iroquois country. So this check and balance system that the Iroquois had consisted of a male chief and a female grandmother. And the grandmother had more power than the chief. Now, she didn't busy herself with running the tribe, but she had veto power. So she could come along and say no to whatever the chief had said yes to. And that veto power was there as a safety valve to make sure that that chief never got too much power and that he never became too, male-dominated in his decision-making. There was this balance between the male and the female. And we find this also in an animal called the bonobo. And the bonobo looks like a chimpanzee, shares a lot of chimpanzee DNA, but in actuality, the bonobo is more closely related to humans than it is to chimpanzees. And we humans are just as closely related to chimpanzees and bonobos. So interesting thing about chimpanzees, they are patriarchal, just like most Western cultures on this planet. Most Western human cultures are patriarchal. And you get four major forms of violence with that. You get infanticide, which is all about killing the babies that you did not father. And you find, records of this both in the Old Testament Bible and the New Testament Bible. In the Old Testament, the Pharaoh was killing baby boys of a certain age because he was trying to kill Moses, who he thought would ascend to his throne. And then in the New Testament Bible, you have got the story of King Herod, who was killing baby boys of a certain age because he was trying to kill Jesus, who he had been told was out to take his power. So humans think they've invented all this stuff. Actually, no, we didn't. The chimpanzees have been doing it for a lot longer than we have, and they're still doing it today. So the other thing, of course, is rape, the whole idea that females are owned by the dominant male and therefore have to submit to sex on command. And in chimpanzees, we've actually documented a great deal of domestic violence as the female is getting closer and closer to her estrus, which is a time when she will be receptive to sexual behavior. She gets beaten. And the dominant male that wants to have sex with her will start beating her 2 or 3 weeks before she's ready to have sex. So that by the time she is ready to have sex, she won't even think about having sex with anybody but him because she doesn't want to get beaten more. So we've got infanticide, rape, and then we have murder. Murder in chimpanzees is all about power takeovers, and it's usually a conspiracy of 2 to 3 males get together and conspire to kill the dominant male who's in charge. And what is traded for that cooperation is sex, so that there are agreements made. Now, how these agreements are made, we're going to have to do more research before we'll ever know that, because how do chimpanzees communicate to each other that they want to kill somebody and that, you know, if you help me murder this old guy, you get sex in exchange. But somehow or another, they are able to strike these bargains, and in fact, they carry them out. And what will happen is there'll be a group of males who will, you know, murder the guy who's in charge, and then they take over the harem. And the two that were the supporting characters, they're not going to be the designated leader. They will get sex, but they do not get leadership privileges. So they're not in charge, but they get to have sex. And this actually sounds really similar to a lot of our history as human beings. You know, when you're looking at patriarchal history, it was all about the hunters, these wild and crazy men on horseback who are great hunters and very, very skilled at killing. And they come into the agricultural basin, you know, the birth of human beings is in there between the Tigris and the Euphrates, really where Iraq is right now, originally called Babylon. This is where, you know, humans as we know them today get their start. And if you read the Old Testament Bible, it's really, really clear that the Philistines and the Canaanites were goddess cultures. They worshipped sex, and they worshipped animals, and they worshipped women, and their women had a great deal of power. And all of this is vilified vehemently in Old Testament Bible. And then there are prescriptions, I should say proscriptions, for committing genocide. So if you read the Old Testament, especially Leviticus, goes into great detail about how, why, when you should kill Philistines and Canaanites, because that land was promised to God's people. Now, I know at this point I may be offending some people who adhere to the Bible, but that's too bad. I would just ask you to go read the Old Testament. Very few people who call themselves Christians have actually read the Old Testament, and it's quite educational just to see actually what it says. So, anyway, there are references in the Old Testament Bible of tearing trees down from high places. And again, this goes back to goddess worship. The goddess worshiping cultures often erected trees and performed ceremonies around trees on the top of hills. And I've actually been over to England and walked on these mounds, if you will. There's a place in England called the Tor, which is actually in Glastonbury. Glastonbury is purported to be the site of all those stories about King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. And if you are a fan at all of the book The Myths of Avalon, you ought to check it out, The Myths of Avalon. It's a huge book. It's over 800 pages long. It took me years to read it. But I do recommend it. It recasts the characters in the King Arthur story so that we get to learn a little bit more about the women, like, you know, Guinevere and Morgana, and there's much more focus on the fairies and Merlin the magician. And anyway, it's a great story. But if you get to see that more from the idea of the ancient early goddess cultures that inhabited England, because they almost everywhere you go on this planet, what's there first is the goddess cultures. That's where, you know, we get the goddess of Wallendorf, the very fecund, full-figured, pregnant female goddess that was very popular and worshipped. And we find all these figurines, and we find crypts. A crypt is where you bury your dead, that are shaped like a woman's womb, so that when you walk in the door, it's like the vaginal canal. And then it opens up into a big room, which is meant to be like the woman's womb. And this is where the dead are redeposited into the bowels of the earth, which is a metaphor for returning to the mother's womb. So all of this metaphor and symbology, you know, the Tor is kind of reminiscent of a woman's breast. And there are actually hills. There's one called Antler Hill where it is believed that the ancient people actually used the antlers, deer antlers, which are discarded every year by the bucks. They lose their antlers and grow them back every year. They would take these antlers and scrape the dirt up until finally they formed this mountain. And why did they do that? Why would they put all this trouble to do that? Well, because the form of this round hill looked like a woman's breast, and that was something that they worshipped and revered. A woman's body part was, you know, a woman's body was powerful. It was one of the biggest miracles going. When you think about it, you know, there were volcanoes and eclipses, and these figured really large on the miracle scale. But then there was childbirth. You know, this entire brand new human being emanates from a woman's vagina. How does that happen? Well, in the beginning, they weren't even sure, which is why we didn't start with patriarchy. Patriarchy is all about who fathered the baby. Well, in the very beginning, human beings didn't even know that men were fathering babies. They just knew that women were having babies. And that's one of the reasons that we start off with matrifocal cultures. But the great thing about matriarchy, matrifocal cultures, not matriarchy, but matrifocal cultures, is that they are more egalitarian. It's usually not about females dominating and terrorizing males. It's usually about a sharing of the power so that women are revered. And what comes out of this always is sex positiveness. Now, you know, when we think about being sex positive, we don't usually think about being pro-prostitution, which is, I think, unfortunate. Prostitution has got a really bad rap in our current ideology because we don't understand what place it has. But let me explain. Ancient sacred prostitution was very much about connecting people to the divine. So, for instance, the kings, as the kings are coming into power and trying to take over the matrifocal cultures and the goddess religions, the only way that they can align themselves with their followers, with their people, with their subjects, is to adopt some of the pagan ways and to adopt some of the standards that go with matrifocal cultures. It's very much like when Constantine wanted to declare the Catholic religion the national religion. And the way to do that was for him to make the Christian and the pagan religions kind of fuse together. So, in other words, Christmas trees did not originate with Christianity. That comes from pagan religion. Same thing with Easter. Easter was originally a rite in honor of a goddess named Ishtar. It's interesting, and they just change it a little bit and call it Easter. You ever wonder why, what on earth eggs and bunny rabbits have to do with Jesus Christ? Absolutely nothing, that's what. But they have a lot to do with the goddess Ishtar. And, you know, bunnies reproduce like rabbits. So that's why the people who worshipped Ishtar, which was a goddess of fertility, would also worship bunny rabbits, and they would use eggs to symbolize that fertility. And that always goes back to sex, because sex produces babies. And at some point people did figure that out, by the way. And, you know, they went from just worshiping women's bodies to also worshiping phallic symbols. And sex became a sacred rite, a doorway to the divine. And this is why prostitution can be considered sacred. Because in that paradigm, sex is not actually considered to be dirty. It's not considered to be something that separates you from what's good in the universe. It's actually considered to be something that connects you with the very best that the universe has to offer. It takes you right to God's doorstep, in fact. And so the sacred prostitutes used sex in order to connect people with things that were good. So whether it was the sacred prostitute in the Epic of Gilgamesh that was civilizing the wild, untamed man, or the Oracle of Delphi, who was a sacred prostitute and who would tell the king what he should do as a seer, a fortune teller, she would tell him what he should do as far as when he might want to declare war or if he wanted to go to war and how to run the country. This came out of the sacred prostitution temples. The men who went off to fight the wars would come back and they would have blood on their hands and they would have all of this fire in their souls and they would have seen horrible things just like our veterans do now. And on some level, they were ruined. They were completely incapable of going home to their wives and making love to their wives because they had seen and done way too much killing. So their first stop would be the sacred prostitution temple. And at the sacred prostitution temple, they didn't ravage the sacred prostitutes. They showed up in order to be healed by the sacred prostitutes. The sacred prostitutes purged that war and that killing out of them. They took them to a place which I like to call transpersonal. It's very much like what you would expect to receive from a priest or a preacher or a rabbi or your pastor. It's personal, but it's not personal. It's something that transcends the personal. That's why we call it transpersonal. And because it transcends the personal, it can take on enormous dimensions. It can catapult you into something that is extremely spiritual and paradigm shifting. And that is, in fact, what sacred prostitution is about. It's about taking people out of the mundane and connecting them with the divine. It might be the divine in themselves. It might be the divine as the sacred prostitute shows up to be a representative or the incarnate representative of a particular goddess. Or it can literally open gateways to heaven, if that's the word that resonates with you. The universe, God, goddess, creative force, higher power, whatever words resonate with you, sex with a sacred prostitute can take you to places that transcend the mundane here on planet Earth. So this is what the men would do. They'd go to the temples and have the war taken out of them so that they could go home and be good husbands and good fathers to their children. The other thing that happened in the sacred prostitution temples was wives would, before they had their marriage ceremony, before they slept with their husbands, they would go down to the temple, and they would spend a day working as a sacred prostitute in the temple before they would consider themselves ready to be wives. So this was considered to be an initiation, a way that women could also move out of the mundane and seek a spiritual connection to their sexuality. And then they would feel that they were ready to marry. So totally, totally different attitude towards sex. By the time you get to some of the pagan rites like Beltane, Beltane is not actually taking place in a temple, and it's not prostitution, but Beltane is ordinary people getting together at a particular season where they feel that they want to go out and fertilize the ground so that the crops will grow, so that they'll have a good, fertile crop that year, and literally have sex in the dirt where they're going to plant the seeds and make sure that their seed, the man's sperm, the woman's ejaculate, mixes with the soil so that the crop that they plant after Beltane will grow just that much better. Part of it is really they're fertilizing the ground, and the other part of it is obviously a ritual meant to evoke the fertility gods, if you will. So sex was used for a lot of beautiful things. And while we're talking about sacred prostitution, we actually have to talk about this whole concept of virgin. What does it mean to be a virgin? Well, most of us think virgin means that you have an intact hymen. The hymen is that piece of skin that most little girls are born with, which creates a closure, if you will. It's kind of like a thin film, like saran wrap. It's not really like saran wrap, but for lack of a better example, let's just say it's like saran wrap over the entrance of the vagina. And it's actually located a little further in. You would have to insert your finger just a little bit before you'd come up against it. But it's a thin piece of skin. And this is where the blood comes from on the wedding night, if you believe in having sex on your wedding night for the first time, or the first time a woman feels like she gets, quote-unquote, deflowered. That is a term I really can't stand. But these are some of the terms we've been given. When a woman has sexual intercourse for the very first time and something penetrates her, whether it's a finger or a penis or a dildo, there is likely to be a little bit of blood, and also some discomfort, some pain, because you're actually breaking that skin, that hymen. Now, we have gotten so hung up on this because, as a culture, we have valued women based upon whether or not that little piece of skin had been broken or not. And if it was broken, then a woman could lose her value. And in some countries, yet today, especially in Africa, women are examined before they get married, before the dowry is paid, before the family invests in this wife. She is examined to find out whether or not she has that little piece of skin. And if she has that piece of skin, then she's an appropriate wife. And if she doesn't have that little piece of skin, she's not an appropriate wife, which, of course, is just absolutely ludicrous and insane. We should be focusing on compatibility issues, whether two people want to spend the rest of their life together, not on little pieces of skin. And just for the record, in Western culture, since young girls are using tampons, usually in their first menarche, and they have their first period, they're going to use tampons, there's a really good chance they're breaking that little piece of skin before they ever have sex. So we wouldn't even be able to use that criteria to determine whether a woman had had sex or not in Western cultures where the use of tampons is normalized. It can also be broken sometimes just from, you know, rigorous exercise and, horseback riding, I've heard. I really don't know if that's possible, but there's some mythology that horseback riding could do it. Anyway, whatever the case, that's what we have hung this word virgin on. But that's not what it originally meant. Not surprisingly, that word has also been usurped and twisted and perverted. Virgin originally meant her own woman. And what that meant was that you were neither owned by your father, and you were not owned by a husband. So it meant that you were an unmarried woman. And at the particular time that this word comes into vogue, a virgin was probably living as a sacred prostitute in the sacred temple. She was married to the goddess. She was in service to the goddess. And she was actually having sex with lots of strangers. That is what the original virgin was meant to be. And here's another little bit of history. The virgin birth. The virgin birth it predates the story of Jesus. And I'm not going to say or even have an opinion on whether or not the story of Jesus is accurate or not. That's besides the point. You may believe in Jesus, you may not believe in Jesus. That's not the point of this discussion. The point of this discussion is just to assert that a story about a virgin birth has been in the human culture for millennia, long before Jesus Christ of Nazareth was purported to have been born. And in the story of the virgin birth, there's a lot of similarities with the Jesus story. There's even ancient stories of a prophet who turns water into wine. So the story is a really old one. I have not been able to establish exactly where that story starts. How did it come to be? At this point, with the research that I've done, and I recommend a book to you. It's called Jesus and the Lost Goddess. You might want to check that out, Jesus and the Lost Goddess. The name of the author fails me right now. It's written by two men, but I'm sure you can find it on Amazon. Just put in Jesus and the Lost Goddess. It's a really good book. It was mind-blowing for me. I thought it was really quite intriguing, this idea that we've had this whole concept of virgin, and I started thinking about how this might be connected to another piece of history. And this has to do with what was happening in the sacred prostitution temples. The kings who were trying to make this power grab, keep in mind, were trying to get people switched over to the idea of a male-dominated system. And in particular, were trying to get them switched over to the idea of a monarchy where you have royal kings who are in charge. How do you do that? How do you get people to start believing in that when what they're doing is having orgies, and they're going to the sacred prostitution temple and having sex with the prostitutes there, and they're having sex out in the fields to celebrate the spring crops and to fertilize the soil. And this is what their life is about. It's actually a really happy, celebratory existence. Now you want to come along and tell them the sex is evil, and that they should wear long faces and stop being happy and stop celebrating and stop having so much sex. And as a matter of fact, we want to start making sex something so evil and vile that we're going to attach a death penalty to it. We're going to stone people who have sex out of marriage. We're going to stone people who, you know, cheat on their wives or husbands or have more than one partner. You know, we're going to castigate people for masturbating. So sex all of a sudden is going to become this really evil thing. This was a transition that was, it didn't take place overnight. We get people to start fearing sexual behavior. But one of the ways that the kings started getting power was by associating themselves with the sacred temple, the prostitution temple, as I had said earlier. And they wanted to assert that their offspring was royal. So keep in mind, royalty, the only concept of royalty that's going at this particular time is emanating from the sacred prostitution temple, because that is where the goddess is served. And the goddess is royal. Okay, so the women who serve the goddess in the sacred prostitution temples are royal. So if you can have sex with those women, which you could, because sex was not taboo, if that woman gave birth to your child, then that would be a royal child. This would be a virgin birth. Now, I did make a little bit of a leap there, and I invite you to do your own research, and if you find out that I'm full of it, please call me, email me. I would love to hear what you found. But at this time, I think there's a really good chance that this whole idea of a virgin birth comes out of the idea that the kings were, in fact, having children with the sacred prostitution temples, and in a effort to establish royal lineage, you know, God ordained monarchies. This is where this came from, and I am patching together a couple of different stories, and it makes sense to me. But again, you know, history itself is a lot of speculation. And the stories that I'm sharing with you tonight, a lot of them I learned from a mentor of mine by the name of Cozy Fabian, who has studied a lot of the original Sanskrit. And she's an amazing scholar that I have a great deal of respect for. You can also do some of your own research. There is a beautiful book called Sacred Prostitute. And it's written by a doctor. Her name is Nancy Qualls Corbett. That last name is spelled Q-U-A-L-L-S hyphen Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T. Sacred Prostitution, Nancy Qualls Corbett. Great book. And she goes into quite a bit about the history of sacred prostitution. Of course, her premise is that there is no such thing as sacred prostitution today. And a lot of people will take that stance. They can swallow the idea that we had ancient sacred prostitution, but they can't wrap their minds around the idea that somebody might still be practicing that. But there are modern-day sacred prostitutes in 2008. And they don't work in temples usually. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they do work in temples. But and I have seen, I've visited some of those temples, and I have to tell you, they're beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful. They usually the colors are gold and red, and there's lots of candles and pillows and curtains, and it's just really opulent and sensuous and beautiful. And the atmosphere is usually very loving and peaceful and accepting and nurturing and welcoming. And that's what I think of when I think of a sacred prostitution temple. Not only what I would envision that it was like in the past, but the modern incarnations of sacred prostitution temples that I've had the opportunity to visit exude that kind of ambiance as well. And what takes place there? Well, sacred prostitution. How would you do that? When I was working as a sacred prostitute, I actually prayed to be a channel for goddess love before my clients arrived. I had a colleague who considered herself a sacred prostitute who would take a portion, usually about 10% of the fee that she charged her clients, and she would give that in honor of her goddess. Sometimes she might donate it to a charity or otherwise pay tribute to her goddess. And most of the sacred prostitutes that I have known have always identified with a particular goddess. Aphrodite is a real favorite one. So is Isis. Isis is where we get the Isis squat, which is a sexual position that is very popular among prostitutes. And at some point, I will talk to you about the Isis squat. You can also buy my book and read about the Isis squat. Or you can make an appointment with me, and I'll tell you all about it on the phone. For tonight, I will leave that a mystery. My goddess, the goddess that I identified with when I was working as a sacred prostitute, was the goddess Lilith. And Lilith predates Eve in the Garden of Eden. And she was a wild woman who refused to lie under Adam. And you can actually find the story of Lilith in ancient Hebrew text. It predates the Old Testament Bible. Lilith was a real pain for Adam. He went and complaining to God and said, "Why have you given me this woman? She refuses to do what I tell her to do. She wants to be on top every time we have sex. She won't do the missionary position and lie underneath me like a decent woman should. I can't live with her anymore." And Lilith was created from the soil, just like Adam was. They were created, both of them, as equals from the soil at the same time. And Adam just could not handle this empowered, feisty woman. So he went to complain to God, and God finally said, "Okay, I will create you a helpmeet, somebody who will help you as opposed to challenge you." And so that was when Eve was created, and Adam was put into a deep sleep, and while he was sleeping, God took one of his ribs, and he formed a woman from one of his ribs so that she would be a little lesser than Adam, and she wouldn't challenge Adam so much. And Eve became the kind of woman that we usually think of when we think of stereotypes about females. She's manipulative. She might be a little coquettish, and she's a little naive. She's easily fooled by the snake, but at the same time, she uses her feminine wiles to lead Adam astray and eventually get them kicked out of the Garden of Eden. But she certainly wasn't rebellious, and she wasn't in his face and telling him no. And she was more than happy to do sex in whatever position Adam wanted her to. So that's how we get Eve created from the rib, because we really started off with Lilith, who was Adam's equal. Now, Lilith was banished from the Garden of Eden. She was sent outside where all the demons lived, and it is rumored that she coupled with the demons, and as my mentor, Cozy Fabian, is wont to say, presumably in any position she wanted. So that's why I like Lilith. She's feisty. She's rebellious. She's not afraid to tell God no. She's not afraid to tell her man no. And I got to admire that in a woman. So anyway, that's a little history about sacred prostitution. You might be wondering what this has to do with your life. I think by studying sacred prostitution, and you'll find that this is echoed by Nancy Qualls Corbett in her book, that we find concepts that we're lacking when it comes to being women in our culture today. So much of what we're told about being women is that we're wrong. You know, our vaginas are suspect. Our menstrual blood is taboo. The smell of our pussies is revolting or dangerous. Our sexual desires are definitely dangerous. And we're called upon to be asexual in a lot of ways, to reject our sexuality. There is this whole whore-Madonna complex, which causes women to be at war with themselves, and women to doubt themselves and to lack that connection to their sexual power. So I think we can learn a lot from the sacred prostitutes in that respect. And as far as what both men and women can learn from sacred prostitutes, we'll probably have to cover that in another episode. Anyway, if you have any questions about tonight's material, and if you found that I aroused any emotions in you, anything that you want to pursue further, please give me a call. My toll-free number is 888-903-0050. That's 888-903-0050. Or just go over to my website, sexwithoutshame.com, and you can check out all the different things that I can do for you. That's it. I will check in with you next week. Thank you and good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian.